Hey, it's Alan, and I just wanted to let you know that you can now listen to the ongoing history of new music early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
A band is like a plant. No, wait. I need you to stay with me on this because, you'll see where this is going. Like a plant, a band grows from seeds to maturity, bursts forth with new seeds, and then eventually withers and dies. It's the whole cycle of life thing, you know? But like plants or animals or any other living thing, the lifespan of bands varies greatly. You could last as long as one rehearsal, kind of like a dandelion. Or you might find yourself on some kind of 50-year anniversary tour, the equivalent of, I guess, a bristlecone pine tree that can live as long as 5,000 years. Okay, I think we've tortured this metaphor long enough. Then we have bands that form, rise to a peak, hit something of a downhill slope, and break up, only to reform again for, there could be any number of reasons. And this leads into a completely new second act. And thus, things begin anew, and maybe even under better circumstances than anyone thought possible. So let's do a case study. Let's have a specific band deconstruct their journey from formation to breakup to reunion. This is the history of Alexis on Fire, in their own words.
This is the Ongoing History of New Music podcast with Alan Cross.
Hello again, I'm Alan Cross, and I'm back with another episode in an occasional series called In Their Own Words. This is where we get a band in the studio and get them to go through their history themselves. In the past, we've heard from Kings of Leon, Our Lady Peace, Matt Good, Finger 11, Sloan, and a bunch of others. But I keep getting email from people asking, could you please do something with Alexis on Fire? Okay, yeah, great, sure. You do know they broke up, right? It's going to be kind of hard to make that happen when everyone is scattered to the wind. I mean, Dallas Green is off doing a City in Color thing. Vocalist George Pettit became a firefighter. Wade McNeil is doing a bunch of stuff, including working as a radio DJ. Drummer Jordan Hastings is filling in with Billy Talent and playing in some other bands. And I'm not even sure where bass player Chris Steele is. Last I heard, he went for a trek in the Himalayas. And I'm serious about that. But then in early 2019, news of a serious reunion, along with new music. This was a chance to nail down this program. So, one afternoon, I managed to wrangle George and Dallas into a room where I got to pepper them with questions about everything to do with Alexis on Fire.
Welcome back. Oh, no, wait. Let me rephrase that. Welcome back?
Yeah.
That's a good word.
What? I heard a couple of weeks ago, I saw the Instagram post, and the internet melted down. Something about a new Alexis on Fire something. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that you have a new song, which we'll get to in just a minute. But the fact is, we have Alexis on Fire. Mm-hmm. What? Why? What happened?
Well, we've been, you know, playing here and there for the last couple years again. Which I think that all started just based on the fact that we were all still close. We all still enjoyed playing with each other. I think it started with we got one show offer a couple of years ago, and it was just like we were all available to do it, and that's where it kind of started. Obviously, we had gone through the whole farewell thing, and
I think we turned some stuff down too. There were some opportunities that came about that we kind of decided, like, I think for a while there, I was holding our breakup quite closely to the chest. Like, mm-hmm. I really liked it. I thought we broke up classily, and like, and then it seemed like coming back would undo that. So there was like some time there where we were turning down offers, and we were like, no, we're done.
Yeah.
And then I think it was just like the changing of the guard. You'd see the pressure from people. You'd see that they clearly wanted it, and you know, we all these offers came in to play these shows, and I was just like, why am I doing this? Why am I holding this so closely? And like, why is it so precious that we broke up? I mean, we all clearly still like each other and like, there's no animosity. And we've all kind of landed firmly on our, you know, like, I think it was important for us to kind of step away from the band for a while too. Like, you know, we were raised by that band. Alexis on Fire was like pretty much from high school until throughout our formative years.
Mm-hmm.
So
just there became no excuse for us to not play.
Yeah.
That's really what it was. You know, we decided to play one show and we played the show and played really well. So there was really no excuse for us to not be playing. Like we thought we were, you know what I mean? If we had played that show and we didn't talk to each other and we didn't play very well and we got a paycheck and we left, we wouldn't have done anything else. I know for sure I wouldn't have, but we played, we felt good about it. And then, you know, a couple of years went by where we were like, well, we'll go to Australia and do a tour. Sort of became like a vacation in a way where we would just meet and do this thing that we all love doing still. And then probably around the summer of last year, I moved back to Toronto full time.
Where were you?
I had a house in Nashville for 4 years and I spent most of my time off the road there. So I think maybe like just all of us being closer, we just decided to start having more like a regular kind of band practice here and there, which then led to us deciding to start trying to, you know, we're like, if we're going to keep playing these shows sporadically, let's see if we can
write something more than nothing.
You could have just wrote it out playing show after show after show.
Yeah.
Like The Who or The Stones or somebody.
Yeah.
But at what point did you decide?
I like to think of us as like The Who or The Stones.
I think we're, yeah, yeah, clearly, no, clearly. No. If you, you know, maybe you know, a little bit up from there.
But no. at what point did you decide that it was, okay, if we're going to do this, let's just be honest and start writing some songs?
I think we're all still quite current. I think it's, I've seen it before where musicians, they get a certain degree of popularity and then they just fall off the planet. They don't pay attention anymore. They don't know things that are going on and they kind of lose touch with what's going on. I feel like we're capable of contributing still. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, if anything, we've gotten better at writing and better at listening to music. So, what would stop us from doing that?
Yeah.
And also, yes, I don't want to play in a nostalgia act. I don't want to go out and just play the greatest hits all the time. I mean, it is a lot of fun to do it, but I do feel like we can contribute.
This is the song that announced the return of Alexis on Fire in early 2019. This is Familiar Drugs. Alexis on Fire with Familiar Drugs from February 2019, the first new material from the group in about 6 years, and the first song from what appears to be the second act of their career. But if we're really going to understand this second act business, we need to begin with the first act. So I had George and Dallas sit down and go through the story of Alexis on Fire, starting at the very beginning. We have a lot to talk about, and I want to get as much of our conversation into this program as possible. So here we go.
Let's go back to the very beginning of Alexis on Fire. What came actually, let's go back to before the beginning. What came before that band?
Well, we were all in bands. We were all in different bands around Niagara. We all met from basically playing in those other bands.
You know? There were three bands, right?
There was, if you count Jesse, our original drummer, he was in a different band as well, so four.
Yeah,
I would say because Chris and Wade were in the same band. They've been in the same band since they were 14 years old.
There was a lot of like, I remember being young and playing in three bands at the same time. Yeah. And there was a lot of incestuous sort of stuff going on within like, you know, the local music scene, people jumping around and stuff like that. But yeah, when Alexis started, I think there were probably, three or four different bands.
I'm pretty sure the Wade's idea when he asked us all to jam at Jesse's house was that just we all play in bands, let's start another one, you know what I mean? Wade just took a bunch of people that were in different bands and just wanted to make another band, kind of like what George just said. And
if you were into music and you were going to local independent record stores at the time, you know, St. Catharines was a beautiful place to be. Hamilton was a great place to be. You know, even Oakville, Toronto, you know, like these were, there were all these places in Southern Ontario that had these local scenes, 200 capacity clubs, 150 capacity clubs, a lot of kid promoted shows, like people who are like in high school, they rent out
a Polish hall,
Knights of Columbus Hall, Masonic Temples, Canadian Auto Workers Union Hall. You could rent those out for a couple hundred bucks. You could borrow or steal a PA from your high school and set it up on the floor. Get your local crummy bands to all pile in there, charge $5, make tickets. People were very, very, they had a lot of ingenuity back then. Wade was one of those kids.
Wade
could promote a show. Wade, at 15 years old, is negotiating. He's down at the Kingwa Court in St. Catharines, which is a Chinese food restaurant. And he would go in there and he'd talk with them. They would pay the bands in beer, which was incredible because we were all underage.
You played at a Chinese restaurant?
Yeah. We played in an abandoned marina. Yeah. We played in, anywhere that have us. Because that's it. Yeah. You could do it anywhere. If you had a room and a plug for the wall, you could do it. Right? And that was...
Because that's all you needed. You didn't... Yeah. Nobody was worried about what it sounded like or what it looked like or anything. It was just, can we do this?
Oh, yeah.
But Wade was, I would say... For St. Catharines and that, like, you know, in that whole scene that George is talking about, Wade was one of the first kids that we all knew that would...
What drove him?
He's just good at that side of things. I mean, our first bunch of real Alexis on Fire tours, Wade booked by meeting people on the internet, like in chat rooms. He met this kid who booked us our first American tour. I mean, we went to all these crazy towns that no one ever heard of, and nobody came.
Yeah, but it was fun.
But it was great.
We lost a ton of money.
By the fact that Wade met some kid who was willing to book a tour. But it's the same thing. Like when I used to be in a band and it was kind of falling apart, I remember asking Wade, because we had just played some shows together, and I said, Wade, are you booking any shows? Can my band get on some of your shows? Like anything, I'll play anything. And he said, well, I'm actually going to, I don't have anything coming up, but I'm thinking about jamming with such and such and such. And he's like, do you want to come over to that jam? And I said, yeah. That was our first band practice.
Now, Alexis has a very distinct sound. And so we're talking, what is this, 2000, 2001?
Yeah, it would have been... That when we first all met, it was like the summer of 2001, I think. Maybe summer of 2000? Late 2000?
Late 2000, and it rolled over probably by then. We knew each other in 2000, and then, yeah.
So who were you listening to that helped inform the Alexis on Fire sound?
Well,
because emo was not a thing. Screamo was not a thing.
It was all in these little pockets, and if you could find it. That was the thing, too. If you were into that kind of music, you would do your best to find it, and then you would find the people who were into it too.
Oh yeah, the biggest bands that were playing the style of music that we were playing were, you know, maybe they'd play at the Cathedral downtown Toronto to 150 kids. It wouldn't be sold out or whatever. It'd just be like maybe if that, you know, a lot of 80 person shows and stuff like that.
George and I met. We met Liam from the Cancer Bats in line at a Converge show?
Probably, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Did we not go? Was it a Converge? Remember, we were in line to go see some band. We drove, and that's where we met Liam, because that's when he was in Vincent Blackshadow.
Remember? And then we went
We
went to like some like Elks Lodge to go see Vincent Blackshadow play one time.
So
and
it was just that, right? So you just found the people that were into the same stuff as you. So it was all, we were all listening to sort of...
Give me some bands.
Okay.
Well, we were, and this is where the sort of amalgamation, I think, of sounds would come in. Like,
yeah.
You know, I was definitely listening to stuff that was a bit more on the melodic side. Like,
no.
Weird, right?
Yeah, but you had like heavy metal chops as well. And there was certain stuff that you expect, like, none of us were listening to the Melvins.
Right.
You were listening to the Melvins, right?
Or Converge. I was a big Converge guy,
Converge,
too.
Yeah, Converge. Yeah, Converge, I think we all kind of came to together. I was kind of more the deep head, early first screamo stuff, like where I was listening to bands like Satia, Love Lost But Not Forgotten, Page 99. We eventually played with a band called Majority Rule. They were all these, like, very... It looked like punk music. The guys who were at the shows, they had like, you know, they'd be wearing like a hoodie with like patches all over it. It was a lot of 7 inches at the back in the day when you go and see a show at a hall too. There'd be vinyl distros. People would come with bins of their own records, and they'd set up like almost like a flea market, and they'd sell records. And that was how you're finding all this stuff and getting it right. So that was kind of the introduction to that scene. We all kind of came up, I think, through hardcore and punk rock and stuff like that, and this was just the next progression of that. You know, you have punk, which turns into hardcore, which turns into post-hardcore, which becomes screamo and all that sort of weirdness, right?
Okay, the name. Let's get the definitive answer for the name.
It's Alexis on Fire. It's
I'll give you teenagers. The definitive story. We had one band practice, so obviously we started to think about what we should call the band, you know. And I was at home, I was watching the Discovery Channel. There was a show on contortionism, and in one of the segments they did a segment on a girl who's a stripper who is also a contortionist, and she, amongst other things, which we would come to find out. But her name was Alexis Fire, and the segment was called Alexis on Fire. And I said, hey, here's a neat band name. Because when you're naming a band, you never think anyone is, well, unless you're Kanye or somebody who's just, you know, you never think that anyone's going to actually hear your band. So you really don't think about the name at all.
Especially a contortionist stripper named Alexis, right, who may at one point somewhere down the line want to talk to you about.
Correct.
That.
Yeah. There were some cease and desist, which we ignored.
But before that, it was a real. I said it to everybody, and everybody was like, "Yeah, that'll work."
Yeah, that's fine.
It was pretty much as quick as that.
I've played in bands with worse names, believe it or not. I think we all have.
We all have. I think it's a great name because
I don't think it is.
It conjures up all kinds of imagery, and I just like the fact that there's an X in it.
Yeah,
it just sounds cool.
Sure. X.
Yeah.
And then we did ourselves a huge favor by just. Absolutely, just for some stubborn bone in all of our collective bodies, we just had to write it as one word, so that for years, still to this day, people go, "Alex is on fire." No,
is it Alex is on fire? Alex is on fire.
But that was us, you know.
Here is a sample from that first record, the self-titled release that came out on Halloween 2002.
So you put together a bunch of songs, and at that same time, somebody is thinking about starting a new record label.
Yeah.
And that would become Distort.
Yes.
And they were looking for somebody to sign. Yeah.
Greg, the guy who ran Distort, he loved aggressive music. And
he was a show promoter in Toronto, too, at the time. He was like bringing through bands that we would have gone to see a lot. He would have booked the first, like, I don't know. Just, Henry Rollins or something like that.
Yeah, like loved Strapping Young Lad. He loved Devin Townsend and stuff like that. But so yeah, he was a champion of aggressive music, which not a lot of people in the music business were or are. But so he happened to his day job was him. He ran the production suite at the writing room at the old EMI Music Publishing Building.
Okay,
down at Adelaide and Spadina. So the guy who used to work, who used to run EMI Music Publishing, Michael McCarty, he started talking to us just about, whatever. And because we started kind of, I don't know if you want to say gaining some popularity, but we started playing a lot around town. And he brought, he convinced Michael to come down to St. Catharines one night and see us play. I think we played at the Knack. Maybe that night.
Yeah, I remember that too, because I remember being all highfalutin about, because I think we sold out the Knack.
Yeah.
And the Knack is like, you know,
the Niagara
100 people or something like that.
And it was a big deal for
it
us.
Was a big deal at the time. I remember feeling all big about it. And then I remember saying that, I was like, hey, sold out show or whatever. And then McCarty said something like, next time you got to have a lineup out the door and people can't get in.
Yeah.
Or something like that. And I was like, Okay, all right.
Big wig.
Big chips.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're clearly from the music industry.
But so we went out, I went out for a beer with him because I was the only one of age at that point.
That's
I think
true.
George was still maybe 18 at the time.
I might have been.
Maybe you, yeah, maybe you
I
were.
I might have just
maybe
not gone out.
Yeah, but.
I might have been too punk.
You might have been too punk.
I don't know.
But so he ended up, you know, I remember Joel, our longtime manager, me and him went and talked to him and we basically said we would, it was sort of like, we're willing to do anything it takes. As long as it's on our terms, you know,
snot-nosed kids.
Yeah, yeah, which is still the way we do it. But he just—I don't know—he saw something in us and gave us a small advance for a publishing deal, which is really ridiculous to think about. A guy who ran a publishing company giving Alexis on Fire a publishing deal, as if we're going to just get, you know, sinks.
Oh my God!
All over the place, you know.
In the new Matthew Broderick film,
yeah,
or whatever. I don't know. That's not happening.
But that allowed us to put a lease on a van and record our first record for free, basically in that writing room after hours.
The artwork for that first album, Watch Out.
Yeah,
one of my favorite pictures of all time, with the two Catholic girls getting ready to go into a knife fight.
Yeah,
do you have a story about that? Because that is a great photograph.
So when you make flyers for a show, back in the day, you'd always have like the name of the band and then underneath it in parentheses or whatever, we'd have a little description of what the band was. And it was always something like, you know, crushing Buffalo metalcore or like, you know, whatever. Yeah. So we always would just, they'd be like, what do you want us to say under your name? And we'd be like, say we sound like two Catholic schoolgirls in a knife fight. And then, cause we had a really bizarre, pithy sort of sense of humor back then. And then when we came time to make the record, we were like, we should do that. We should get photographs of two Catholic schoolgirls in a knife fight.
Yeah.
And then I took all those photographs for that album. We had our friend put it all together for us into a CD, and it became it really was iconic
the girl,
imagery.
The girl closest
for a while.
To the girl that you see the knife in her hand. That was my ex girlfriend, my girlfriend at the time.
Mm-hmm.
We just made her and her friend wear Catholic high school because they were going to Catholic high school.
Yes,
and yeah,
they were still in high school.
Those were real deal
were
Catholic
real
school.
Morris,
wow.
Catholic
we didn't rent
school.
Those costumes. Those were their Catholic schoolgirl outfits. And we like and
breaking
we
any
all,
laws? I don't know.
No, probably but we're in high school too. That's what we have access
well,
to.
I wasn't.
You weren't. You're a creep.
Yeah,
but you know. But I'm still legit.
Yeah,
I don't know. No.
You were taking photos of them.
I was
so
taking
maybe,
photos. Yeah.
I don't know.
That was my like wormy way of trying to meet women when I was young, I think. When I was like teenager, I'm like, ooh, I'm a photographer. Isn't that interesting? Come over and I'll photograph you. And then I'll make you a mixtape. Yeah.
When we come back, we'll pick things up from the Watch Out album as we continue with Alexis on Fire in their own words. This is another In Their Own Words edition of the Ongoing History of New Music. And this time, I made George Pettit and Dallas Green of Alexis on Fire go through the story of the band. And we're going to rejoin the conversation around the time the group released their second album, Watch Out.
This isn't radio friendly.
Yeah.
And you guys have never made any apologies for not being radio friendly.
No, I think the whole idea of us making that record or sounding the way we did was, again, same with them naming the band. Like, there was no delusions of grandeur whatsoever. I mean, there still aren't. I mean, this years later, it was just, we wanted to make music, you know?
Yeah, the top of the heap would have been playing to 200 people at the cathedral downtown Toronto.
Yeah.
That was as big as the aspirations. We knew that playing this type of music was going to doom us to obscurity, like a lot of those bands. And that's just, but that's just the way it was. It didn't matter. Like, it just didn't clock on our radar. Like, the idea of being on the radio or being on Much Music or any of that stuff was just, that's on Venus.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like,
yeah, but it didn't quite turn out that way.
Well, you know what? It took.
But
it
they
took,
came around to us.
It took,
right?
Exactly. Like, I was going to say, it took people, the people that were closest to us, it took them believing that it could be something more than what we thought it could be. So it took people like Joel and Trisha, our managers, and Greg for that matter, and Michael seeing something in us, and people along the way, George Strombolopoulos helping us from the beginning, like wearing our t-shirt on Much Music.
And he brought us on Much Music before we had anything recorded.
Yeah, so it was a combination of, I guess, whatever the music we were making,
but mixed with people from the get-go that were just willing to tell other people about it, as opposed to trying to make a radio song and hope that it would get played. It was just, we did what we did and we had some other good people in our corner. And then it just got to the point where everybody else had to start paying attention to us because kids were listening. And
yeah, they
and it
were.
Was like, we're doing this without you guys, so you can come on board. Or, and that was really solidified by when Much Music used to have a show where people would call in and vote for their favorite video. And it was always like the popular song. But when we made our first music video, one night our song, our video got to number one.
Which was that?
It was Pulmonary Archery. It was our first music video. And that was really like, that was the night where everybody was just like, well, I guess we have to, this is the one that won. We have to play at number one. And it was like, that was sort of the moment where I think the music industry and the radio and all that were kind of like, well, people like this band and we're not doing anything about it.
Well, here's the thing, you know? About Much Music back in the day is that it linked a kid in St. John's, Newfoundland with a kid in Yellowknife.
Yeah.
And you could turn it on and see an Alexis on Fire video and go, that sounds like I feel.
Yeah.
And it's
the kid. It did the same thing for us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
City Limits. Like, I'm not here if I didn't have City Limits to watch and tape every night if I was going to sleep and then watch all the music videos that got played on City Limits and find all these bands that I'd never heard of. And that's what I think, you know, you can do that now wherever you want on the internet. But
it's not the same.
It isn't the same.
Because, you know? I think with a band like Alexis on Fire, and we can debate this, but it's more about connoisseurship than it is consumption.
Sure.
Because back then, before streaming, before, you know, the internet, you had to seek out this stuff. And you physically had to seek it out. You had to either go to the show, or you had to know somebody and get their record and listen to that record or that CD or whatever it was. It's not like you had 50 million songs that you could get on your phone any second now.
Right.
You carefully curated that music that, like I said, sounded like you felt.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
you invested in it.
And I think that something that we always try to make clear, too, is that, you know, we just happened to be the band that got the opportunity for that. Do you know what I mean? We never looked at ourselves like we were changing the game or we were the best band doing this sound. We just happened to be the band that got that video and got, we had a bunch of open doors and
you were in the right place.
Stars
right
aligned
time.
And that's a lot of it. And that's a lot of it for there are, and that's the aggravating thing about music in general is that you do have these incredible bands that either fall by the wayside or people forget about them or they never make it to that level. Mm-hmm. And it's not for lack of hard work or talent. It's just, they were never in that right exact spot at the right exact time. And we just, we made Lightning Strike, you know, like that's what happened with us. There are, and it happened, I mean, like, not to turn this into a rant about Canadian music, but we do, like, as a culture, I think we tend to prop up not necessarily the best of our culture. We prop up what's palatable and the big, you know, like, and we tend to throw away the best stuff that we make as a culture. Yeah. Like, you know, like, I don't know. So we were lucky in that we didn't fall through the cracks. But yeah, one turn, we play the wrong show. We don't meet Greg Below or Mike McCarty. Or our video fact grant ends up in the wrong table in the wrong place,
gets
denied. Or any of those things doesn't happen. And yeah, you're not sitting here talking to us.
Where does Billy Talent come into the picture?
Well, I think for us it was kind of the two bands where we both got that same opportunity around the exact same time, you know? And it was like that, it was the same, it was the video coming out and that kind of sort of allowing the rest of Canada to see us, because we had started to build our own little fan base in Niagara region, because we would take every weekend and try and go and play wherever we could. And I think when Pulmonary started getting played across Canada, it was the same time Billy Talent and Trihonesty started clicking, and they started getting radio attention as well. And then we did a tour together.
Package together, yeah. We went across Canada with Death From Above.
Yeah.
And that was, yeah.
That was where we got to see it every night, you know, because we had only played Southern Ontario, really.
Yeah, Quebec. We'd go up to Quebec, do some shows up there.
So we got to go across Canada with Billy Talent and see these, you know, 500, 600 cap
This
rooms.
Is around the Watch Out time, right?
This was still the first record. So maybe 2002, three, okay. maybe. Mm-hmm. And we saw that happen. And it was like, okay, there's obviously, there's a bunch of kids across this country who are looking for some way into this aggressive music, into this music where they can feel something than what they're being shown on the radio, or excuse me, shown on the TV or hearing on the radio. And that was kind of a big moment for us. It gave us the sort of spirit to then cross the border at the end of that tour and go down, literally play the Croatian Cultural Center in Vancouver with Billy Talent to 1,000 people, and it'd be one of the best nights of our life, to then cross the border and go play in Bellingham, Washington for no one.
The bar staff.
We played for the bar staff.
I don't even think I played the show.
You didn't.
I didn't.
You folded t-shirts because your voice was bothering you. We played for the bar staff, and that was a good moment, you know? And we've had many moments like that throughout the years where you get super stoked, and then immediately it's pulled away from you, and that's how you never develop an ego. It's pretty good.
So we get to the third album, and at that point, again, running the radio station at the time, and Crisis comes in, and we had a guy named Barry Taylor working at the radio station at the time, who was a huge promoter of Alexis on Fire. Says, we can't ignore these guys anymore. We got to get them on the radio. And we ended up playing it. And other people in the company, you know, my boss specifically, like, what are you doing? It's rating suicide. Yeah. But it wasn't, because somehow this is 2004, 2005.
Well, Crisis would have come out in 2006, so we probably would have been.
But during that time, we were seeing the end of the spike in pop music, you know, the
right,
Backstreet Boys and the NSYNCs and Christina Aguilera's and Britney Spears. And that group of people who had been into pop since the middle 90s with Spice Girls and whatever, they were now getting older. And they were getting angry. And they were looking for something that spoke to that anger and their fears and their frustrations. And you guys and Billy Talent and a few other bands were in the right place at the right time. And this, again, we can go back to My Chemical Romance. We can go back to, you know, any of those emo bands that started becoming mainstream at that time. And it was huge.
Yeah. Well, I remember we did a long American tour with, it was us, My Chem, and Avenged Sevenfold. But right before both them have just signed their major label deals, and both had made the records that would then propel them into superstardom. But it was the tour right before that. And I remember them talking to those guys, and they had just spent a year being courted by major labels, and they were definitely talking like they had just been courted by major labels. But it was like, you could kind of see this thing, like, you know, we were like, wow, this is crazy. Like, it's, you know, and then that was kind of when Island came in and signed Thrice and Thursday, and this whole, like, the entire music industry was looking for something else.
Yeah. Yes. I remember, like, Cave In was about to,
they got signed.
They got signed, yeah. And they was like,
because of
they
Dave
were
Grohl
poised and ready to, like, be that next, oh my God, who was the first musicians to come out of that, like, you know, Hydra Head, Equal Vision, you know, Vagrant Records thing. Like, who is going to be the first one to come out of there and be like, you know, and go to be playing on Letterman or something like that?
It was strange. And you saw it happen with all the bands in our scene in our area. Every band that was kind of doing something all got signed by the really big American indie labels. You know, Monin got signed by Vagrant. Silverstein got signed by Victory Records. Who else was there? The End got signed by Relapse. Yeah. We got signed by Equal Vision. It was just like everybody was trying to look for something. And like you said, we just happened to be there when it was happening. And I think the other thing too that we don't give ourselves enough credit for is we had the resiliency and the drive to do something with every opportunity where we were given, you know? Because I think a lot of it is you get an open door. It's what you do once you go through it, I think.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Because a lot of the times you can just make the wrong decision or have something thrown in your face and just say, all right, I'm done with this.
But I will say this in full humbleness. Alexis on Fire delivers when it comes down to like the moment, like if we need to do something.
Can you quote George on that, please? So
no, but like it is like no, it's true. we haven't botched anything. Like we've been given opportunities. You play in the Much Music Video Awards. You get a gigantic stage to yourself. We do it.
Yeah,
we know how to do it. And so that's, I don't know. Yeah. We deliver.
Fully humble.
I know. That was a joke.
On August 22nd, 2006, Alexis on Fire released their third album, and it went straight to number one on the Canadian album chart, selling more than 20,000 copies in its first 7 days. Nobody in the industry saw that coming.
We busted open some doors, and it allowed some other people to
access. Well, there's no question you did. There is absolutely no question you did, because there was no one doing what you guys were doing at the level that you guys were at, having the amount of success that you were having, against all odds.
See, I think too, going back to what we were just talking about, I think if we had have felt that way back then, we wouldn't have continued to try to make better music or outdo ourselves. Like, I think that
it's a very Canadian humble thing.
Well,
you
but
know?
I don't think,
yeah,
I think
when we were kind of a cutting your friends up sort of thing, yeah, too. Yeah. I think anybody walks into the room with Alexis on Fire, you feeling a little good about yourself.
Yeah.
Guess what?
Yeah.
You're stepping into
you
the
got no chance.
Tank, my man.
More from George and Dallas and Alexis on Fire in their own words in just a second. Remember what I said at the beginning about bands having a definite lifespan before things start to wither? Alexis on Fire was not immune to this. Let's pick up our conversation with George Pettit and Dallas Green.
You made a number one album without even trying.
Well, we tried.
I know
what you're saying. I know how you're...
Yeah. Without trying to make a hit.
Yeah.
You just did everything on your own terms, and it turns out that your own terms was a hit.
Our world at the time was the road, too, especially before that. On Watch Out, so much touring, all this touring. We were thinking about the stage. Even when we're in the studio, we're writing songs with the stage in mind. When we're writing a song like, you know, This Could Be Anywhere in the World, I can almost hear how the crowd is going to react to that. Because we'd got that on Watch Out. We had a song, you know, like we had a song like Accident, which had a huge crowd participation. We had songs like Get Fighted, crowds clapping and singing along.
Yeah.
And that felt so good that, you know, you're making that with, we made that in mind with Crisis.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, as much as we want to talk about how we were different and all that stuff, there was a pop sensibility to what we were doing, I think.
Well, we were getting better at it.
Yeah, we were writing choruses. Yeah, and we were writing, we were writing things that you can imagine people singing back at you.
Yeah.
So we moved to the old Crows record, which again, another massive success, and a lot of radio play for that record as well.
Yeah.
So this is the fourth album. Fourth? Yes. Yeah. How did that record come together?
Well, we spent a lot of time touring for Crisis, like 2 years probably. Yeah. And then I was also doing City and Color pretty heavily at that time, too.
That was 2006-ish?
This was about 2006 to 2008. It was pretty much straight, you know, once that record came out, we were gone.
Yeah, we did a lot.
So I think, you know, when we stopped touring for that record, and I was kind of still touring a little bit on my... whatever record came out in between that one and Old Crows. I think, we had not afforded ourselves enough time to take a break, but for 8 years straight, we had made a record, toured straight, came home, took a month, made a record, went back on the road. And
yeah,
then I was doing that twofold. And so I needed some time to just stop. But I think we took a little bit more time putting the songs for Old Crows and Young Cardinals together.
Yeah.
There were more choruses on that record.
Yeah, yes. I remember we had it down. We were recording demos in the we were recording. Yeah, we were
in the insulation factory.
Yeah. We were in the back. We had a back room rented at an insulation factory
in St. Catharines.
It's an actual
insulation. Yeah. We're probably all going to get mesothelioma, I think, at some point. Yeah. There's a class action lawsuit right now going through. No, but we did that, and yeah, we're recording demos of the songs and really kind of chewing them up and thinking about them, dissecting them, self-editing a lot more. And then there were changes. There were changes coming down the pipe. I was attempting to a different style of singing. And we continued that process because I don't think any of our records sound the same. We always wanted to kind of throw them a little curveball, try something a little different. And as much as it was a success, it was a step down from Crisis. And I think that...
Step down in what way?
It just... I think until that point... It was just step up after step up after step up. Like, we were always making a little bit of progress. There was always something a little bit bigger coming down the pipe. And we got used to that. And it came out. It wasn't number one. It did well. I think we did a tour on it. And it was the first time that we saw a bit of a drop that summer in ticket sales as well.
Well, and in some ways, certain places.
In certain places, yeah. In certain places, there was just like... We were used to this constant stream of like our own personal glory, I think. Anyway, I was. and when I remember it being almost a bit of a hit, that record, because we had tried to do this new thing. We knew it was going to be challenging. And it didn't, like, it wasn't by any means a failure, but it did feel like we had hit the ceiling with Crisis, and now we were taking a step down from that. And that took some processing after touring for, you know, you tour for 10 months out of the year, a couple of years in a row, you know, like that, it puts the doubt in your mind almost, I think. And I think that was seeding what was about to happen.
We had done well in all these different places in the world, but America, it was always sort of really, we seemed very distant from what was popular there. And I think we were fine with it. It was just maybe like curiosity got the best of us. So we tried to like hammer it a couple of times. And I remember like during that doing that full Warped tour was easily could have broke the band
up.
It
was a disaster doing that.
And then we did a couple of really long American tours that were just really unfulfilling. When you're touring all year, it's hard. When you're touring all year and only 60% of the shows are good, it's hard. When you tour all year and maybe 40% of the shows are good, and you spend 6 months touring a place that just is not working, it kills you.
There was a fifth album. What happened to it?
Well, I guess Dog's Blood, when we started writing the songs for the Dog's Blood EP, which would come out after Old Crows, we started writing those songs, and then that's kind of when I had made the decision to leave the band. So that sort of obviously stopped the writing process. And
yeah,
we have these four songs that we liked, and I said to the guys, you know, like, I want to finish this, just like I wanted to finish the year of touring. So... That's really the story, is that we were starting to write new songs, and then I left the band.
Yeah, and then I think we attempted writing without Dallas for a heartbeat, where we were like, okay, well, we'll keep going, and yeah, I don't know, it didn't necessarily. I don't think that was going extremely well. I mean, we were coming up with songs, but it wasn't Alexis on Fire, and we were just like, okay, well, maybe instead of us coming back and doing this bastardized version of the thing, maybe it's time we lay this down and stop it. And Wade had the opportunity to join the Gallows, so he went and did that, and we all went our separate ways.
But it was amicable.
Yeah, I mean, it was to a degree. Obviously, when I quit the band, nobody was stoked about that.
I think it took time. It took time, and to your credit, Dallas, like you could have, you probably should have left Alexis on Fire 4 years earlier.
No,
I think.
I didn't want to.
No, I know you didn't want
to. Everybody can say that, but that's the thing. Nobody understands that I didn't leave the band because I wanted solo success. I left the band solely because I had creatively, I wanted to do something else.
Absolutely.
And that's it. So
absolutely.
If I could have stayed in both,
I'm telling you right now.
I'm doing it again. I'm back.
I know. I'm just saying, I'm doing TV shows at the time.
Yeah, I know.
My TV career takes off.
You're gone.
I might have been out the door.
Yeah, no, I understand that.
Wade, if the Black Lungs takes off,
I understand that.
Wade might be out the door. Yeah. Like that's like we'd been like you probably and City in Color had eclipsed Alexis on Fire at that point. And it made sense. Like I'm sure you had people in your life who were just like, "What the f*** are you doing?
No.
Go and do City in Color."
I will say this on a closing note again. I will say this. The proof of the matter of that is whenever I tried to pick up a guitar in that era, I couldn't write any more aggressive stuff. It just wasn't coming. And for me, the way I've always done things, I don't never force anything. I never make a record just because it's time to make one. I have to have the songs. And I just couldn't see myself writing songs. And then I knew that if I did stay, I would have been forcing it and it wouldn't have been good, at least on my point. But I did always say all these years that I haven't been doing it, people would be like, you know, you distance yourself from heavy music stuff. I said, no, if I write a riff, if I come up with something that like, if I want to play heavy music again and it's there, I know four guys who I can do it really well with. And that's it.
And another thing, like now that the dust is settled too, I mean, like the breakup was the best thing to happen to all of us. Mm-hmm. It really was.
That's why we're here doing
it. It's why we're here doing it now. And also like, yeah, just our lives profoundly changed. Every single one of us found something else. Mm-hmm. And that became, and we needed it. We needed that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Yeah, there's no. So and thank you. Thank you for leaving Dallas.
You're welcome.
And now, the point in the story that features the joyful reunion.
I think we all needed to take a break from it, so it didn't get us to the point where we were at each other's throats and never wanted to speak to each other again. Because people don't, a lot of people, and I'm not saying woe is us, but, you know, it's very hard to be in a band forever and to do it well for a long period of time. It gets difficult to live like that, you know?
Especially like, 23-year-old George bowling around in the world, playing rock shows every night, jumping off the stage is one thing. I'm still kind of doing that, just less and less. Yeah. But now, you know, you have family involved. You have aspirations outside of music. You do things like that, you know. I mean, I've got a son and a wife and a house. Those are important things to me, you know. And the idea of, I wouldn't want to go back to 10 months out of the year on the road. That's not important to me.
Yeah.
But it's also like, I do still want to play. Yeah. And that's not going away. And once in a while, you kind of think it is. And then all of a sudden you're standing at the side of the stage and there's like 10,000 people that want to see you. And you step out there and it all just comes rushing back. Like we've carved this neural pathway through our brains through 12 years of playing music, stage every night, you know, and it just comes back like that, like a snap, mm-hmm. you know? So I don't know. I'm glad we're still doing it. And I'm glad, I hope I still get to do this in the capacity that we're doing it, you know?
And see, all that time in the van has set everything up for today so you can do things on your own terms.
Yeah.
Precisely.
And we're very cognizant of that and appreciative of it as well. You know, I was very, very happy to be able to come back to the band and play because, you know, from the day when I said to everybody I'm going to leave, you know, there was a part of me that thought that might be the end of this. You know what I mean? Like, so for me personally, to be able to think about all the time that we spent doing it and to be able to sit in a room and with my friends and still write a tune that we think, you know, that jazzes us all, and then we get to go and play it for people and they're jazzed. It's a great feeling, you know?
Before we wrap up, I want to thank George and Dallas and everybody associated with the Alexis on Fire camp who made it possible for this interview. It's always really, really difficult to get people in the same place at the same time to hold these kinds of conversations, and I'm glad we were able to get it done. This program is available as a podcast. If you want more, just go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your on-demand audio. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of podcasts available for free. Just download and go. And if you can, please rate, review, and share. That really helps us a lot. If you're looking for more information about a variety of things, there's my website, which is ajournalofmusicalthings.com. It's updated every day. And to remind you of the daily updates, there is the daily newsletter. It's free, too. You can sign up at the website. You can also find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and email should go to alan@alancross.ca. So pick your connection point. Technical production is by Rob Johnston. Talk to you next time. I'm Alan Cross.
You've been listening to the Ongoing History of New Music podcast with Alan Cross. Subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, and everywhere you find your favorite podcasts.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.